And we're live with our 297th episode of Absolute AppSec. I'm Ken Johnson at CK Tricky on social media, joined by my co-host Seth Law at Seth Law on social media. Seth's AI.
Hey everyone. Well, apparently that's where we're going today. It's not like we've done 297 of these. This is our second one, right, Ken? Something like that. There's a two in there somewhere. Welcome back to another episode. Thanks for joining us today. Happy to be back as always. We got a few things to dig into today. We do want to talk a little bit about the breach, like npm debug and a couple of other things. But before we get into it, I did want to announce that we will be running a virtual Harnessing LLMs for Application Security course on October 9th and 10th, so in about a month, and would love to have you there, right? So this is the course that people have been asking for. This is a version of what we did at DEF CON. It's come quite a ways since we first actually introduced it. So this is all about how we use LLMs in application security, specifically static analysis, dynamic analysis, how you put that together, and how you actually operationalize use of LLMs. So this is not just going to ChatGPT and typing things in, or even just using Copilot or Windsurf or whatever it is and the chat agents, but it's actually operationalizing a lot of the activities that we do on a daily basis. So please, consider us. The link is up. Registration is open. Would love to have you there. We do like to fill up these courses, and they do fill up rather quickly. So please come along with us. Outside of that, there is the full 4-day version of Secure Code Review and Harnessing LLMs. That's the next level Secure Code Review or next gen Secure Code Review at Black Hat Europe. That's going to be in December. Those seats are also selling. Would love to see our European compadres, or however you want to call it, people in Europe, at that course as well. Yeah. Outside of that, Ken, I know you've got some travel coming up. Were you back in Vegas, or you're going back for ETS? Is that your next jaunt?
Yeah, you're right. ETLS. I don't know, like with OWASP DC one, what I'll do there. I'm sure I'll show up. But those are the only HughesecCon too, I guess. I don't even know when HughesecCon is, but I think I'm supposed to go to that one too. So yeah, a few opportunities to meet up with folks. And then, probably after that, I don't know about you, Seth, but I'm thinking, I guess we got Black Hat in December.
Yeah.
I was gonna say after November, probably no more travel, but we got Black Hat, so.
Yeah, we have Black Hat. It'll be good. Outside of that, I've got a couple of local conferences like B-Sides Cache Valley, B-Sides Red Rocks, which is down close to Vegas. It's in St. George, but it's still in Utah. So down around Zion National Park and the rest of that stuff. Those are coming later this year. Or actually, B-Sides Cache Valley is this Friday. I don't think there's going to be a lot of listeners at that one. It's more of a local meetup. Local conference, but it'll be good. And
it's Cache
County. Besides Cache.
Oh, I see. Cache County.
Mm-hmm. So Cache County, that's the, I actually grew up in Cache Valley, right? Like Cache County, right? Like that's where my son is going to university up there, right? Like that's where Utah State is. Yeah. Small tech community that's up there, but there's a lot of kind of good stuff that has happened in that area. So if you're going to be in town, tickets are really, it's a true B-Sides event. Tickets are very inexpensive. I think students, it's free. And, if you're a professional, the $20, if you want an electronic badge, then it's a couple $100, right? That type of thing. But it'll be good. One day event, I think the guy that does the Wi-Fi Cactus, Mike Spicer, is one of the keynotes, and he's local to Utah here, right? So it'll be a good time. I'm excited for it.
Yeah, you've got the general, so students free, general admissions $22. And then if you want to like sponsor a student plus get like a VIP badge and engraved cup, you can spend $235. But that's extra. You trying to do something nice and get a fancy badge. E-badge.
Yes. I don't know. I have a serious question for you about e-badges, Ken. What do you do with e-badges?
After the conference or during?
No. After the conference. I should show you my bin of badges.
It's a bin of badges. Bin. Yeah.
And I like, they're super cool, but I have a really hard time of knowing what I should actually do with them because I just never get back to them. So I really appreciate the conferences where you have to go and solder a badge together, but sometimes you don't get to it at the conference and I never get back to it, right? Like that kind of activity is just like on a day-to-day basis. Like some I've had my kids put together, but what do you do with those things after the fact, right? Like it's sometimes I feel like it's almost wasteful from a like e-waste perspective, like the electronic badges, right? Like I think it's an interesting thing. It's super fun to do, but I don't see people using them after the fact.
Yeah, it's a good point. It would be cool if like I don't know any practical way to do this, but it would be cool if somehow you could progressively each conference bring back the same badge and continue adding on to it in some way so you're not wasting it. But yeah, you're right. Like I've thought about that before. I'm like, I got a lot of junk basically, and I don't feel great about just throwing it out. And I don't really know. A perfect example would be, Colonel Khan had a watch like a few years ago. And I loved it. And so I still have it next to my 3D printer. I have like I have a pretty big workshop for my son and I to kind of 3D print, do Dremel and all that stuff. But pick locks and like, that's one of the things too, is I have that watch sitting there waiting to start like trying. Obviously it's not usable outside you can't play the game outside the conference, but just to see if like we can load our own software on there, just have some fun with it, tweak with it. That's about it, man. And I still, again, like I'm saying that full well knowing there's like a ton of dust on that box and I haven't touched that thing in forever. So.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. Well, and that's what I kind of come back to, right? Like, so not this year, but last year, DEF CON had like the game that was built into the badge that was super cool. And they put, like people put blood, sweat, and tears into designing these badges and the games that go into them, the software that's built into it. It's a very good like learning experience and, manufacturing, like the whole pipeline type thing. And I feel bad, right? At times that I just don't get to it, right? I like it's, really love to have, some opportunity there. And that's from Robert, that's a great suggestion, right? Like don't solder them and bring them to other cons so people can, like younger people that maybe don't have it could do something with it. I don't know, like, at some of the local events, that's what I've started to do is I'll pay for like B-Sides Cash, for example, right? If I get an electronic badge there, I'm probably handing it to a student that doesn't have like the money to do it, right? Because I know I'm not going to get to it. Same thing at Cactus Con and some of these others. I've done it in the past and I know I can, but I also don't want to necessarily just take it home and have it sit and be bin, right? Because eventually it will just become e-waste. So.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it just becomes junk at this point. By the way, I did let our listeners know, forgot to put it in the Slack that we're live. So I did let people know in our Absolute AppSec Slack that we're live. In any case.
Okay.
Moving on.
Cool. Yeah, moving on. I'm going to put in the link to training in there as well. Sweet. Well, with that, there's a couple articles that we wanted to talk about today. I think the first one that we want to talk about, I know we're going to get to debug and the NPM stuff that's happened because it just feels like that's a constant stream. But the other one that we want to talk about is about framing security alerts. Oh, okay. So the name of the article is "What Framing Security Alerts as a Binary True or False Positive is costing you? And this is one that you actually brought up. And like, so my initial question to you is why? Like, what is it that interested you about this article, about this discussion of true versus false positives? Because this is something that we deal with a lot, right? I am doing a static analysis, or I'm doing dynamic analysis of an application, and I have one of my tools, Burp Suite or something else, tell me that there is a vulnerability. So I can either alert on that, or I can create a finding about it. But what is it that was interesting to you about this article?
I mean, well, personally to me, you know, I spend a lot of time thinking about what is a false positive, because, you know, our company does contextual security analysis. Most people can think of that as SAST like in their minds, S-A-S-T, with quite a bit more intelligence behind it. But in any case, what you find is that you tend to get, let's put it this way, and I'll go through the article and explain it, but there becomes this nuanced, murky territory that you get into where you're like, no, we're correctly surfacing things that need to be surfaced, or correctly detecting the right signals and surfacing those signals. But then there comes, oftentimes it comes down to what's the business impact, and then the interpretation of whether or not that signal is meaningful in that context, right? And I know that sounds a little abstract, but it's basically like, think about somebody who, I'm going to use a silly example. Somebody includes MD5, but the MD5 is for nothing security centric. Maybe it's even just something for like a demo to show and print out that, you know, I don't know, like, here's what the output of MD5 looks like. I'm just making something up. So let's say somebody cuts pull requests for that. Well, a tool can correctly call out, hey, you're using MD5. And there should be, especially with what we are doing, there should be some level of understanding, like, here's the file location, here's how it fits into the wider code base, here's the intention behind it. So maybe you can filter out based off of all of that, that like, hey, this is MD5, but it doesn't matter for these reasons, right? But there are times where that's harder it gets more nuanced, and that's more difficult. And I spend a lot of my life these days, you know, trying to sort out the best ways to manage that. And so what this article was in, what was interesting to me about this article is that there was this, I've never seen it until this article, but I guess signal detection theory was a framework developed in the 1950s. And if you scroll down, they kind of, yeah, right there. So these are the four categories that they summarize up to, which is a true positive, as in the signal was present and you correctly detected it. A false positive, the signal wasn't present, but you thought you detected it. A true negative, the signal wasn't present and you correctly ignored it. So that's, you know, good. All right. False negative, that's a problem. The signal was present, but you failed to detect it. Okay. And for many, many years, especially with deterministic SAST, this has been sort of the way that we calculate out, you know, the value of the tool, right? And benchmark it is like, what's your false negative? What's your true positive? What's your false positive, et cetera. Mm-hmm. The problem lies with, in this more intelligent way of analyzing code, it's not binary like that. It's not as simple as that. You have to take into account, like I said, the intention, the risks, the behavior, and a lot of other factors to kind of blob them together to see if this is something worth talking about. Right. So then if you go down further in the article, they propose a new way of doing this, or a new way of classifying. And it's more about business impact. So what I thought was interesting is, yeah, so they say, okay, actually, if you could scroll just a little bit up to the first one and two, not on this list, but yeah, there you go. So there's two different questions. Did the rule work as designed? That's the first question. But then the second question, did the alert have security value, right, in this environment? But, or like, it says environment, but you could just say, like, in this situation, does this alert have security value? So they do a more refined classification. So there's four options here. There's true positive malicious. That's correct detection of confirmed malicious activity requiring a response. So this is like, for sure, this is bad. Something has to happen. We need to take action. Great. Good detection. True positive suspicious and correct detection of unusual or potentially risky activity that warrants an investigation. And I have to say, that's where I spend a lot of my time. I say my and I, and what I really mean is we and our for our product and whatnot. That's where it gets like interesting, right? Is the correct detection of unusual or potentially risky activity might warrant investigation, might warrant digging in. But it may end up being something that's not actually an issue for one reason or another, or it's just something you all for one reason or another are not concerned about, even though it, like, anyway. So then there's a third option, which is a true positive with no business impact. So like that MD5 example I gave out, that would be, you know, yes, MD5 was used, but hey, no business impact. And the last one's the most obvious, false positive. And I think that for me, it's helpful because in this moment in time, all of us are trying to, all of us in the world of moving on to new ways of detecting security issues and code flaws. We're trying to, all of us, grapple with, you know, how do you think about this? You know, how do you deal with contextually relevant signals that then for some reason or another aren't really, you know, a business impact. And you see that handled, and I'll just, the last thing I'll say before I turn it over to you, and I'm going to ask you a question here. You see that with, like, for instance, there are some tools like CodeRabbit, for instance. It does functional security reviews and things of that nature. Dosubot's another one where I remember LangChain team was using Dosubot for a while on their open or on their repos so that it basically triaged issues. So somebody would open issue and say, hey, look, like, you know, I'm having this problem, and Dosubot would go and try and it would do the same thing for PRs, if I remember. But the point is the way they handle that is like they take feedback via comments and then they like incorporate it into their analysis, right? And then over time build up essentially tribal knowledge about the organization they're doing stuff for. That's kind of been the way that everyone in this new world has been handling it. And so I just feel like this article really, it's whether it's in the AI space or if it's like for you as a consultant, I mean, and that's my question. Like, I think if this is valuable for everybody across the board, depending like, or yeah, probably valuable, but what do you think for consulting? Is this valuable? Is this something that's in your mind?
It is, right? This has always come up as we find issues. Right. What is the true value of a cross-site scripting vulnerability? Right. Like, what is the true risk that's associated with it? And right, like especially like self cross-site scripting. Right. Like with CSPs and other things in place. Right. Like there are risks that are associated with that, and context matters. I mean, you know, we've always had arguments with development teams about risk ratings or risk severity, because they view things within the business in general views things within the lens of their threat profile, right? And what they consider their threat profile to be. Whereas a security person, and especially a consultant coming in and analyzing a single scoped application, has to consider the absolute worst thing every single time. And so those severity ratings don't always match up. So just because a vulnerability exists, and this is where I agree with what he's going into here, or they are going into here, is that the context matters, right? Like without an understanding of the true risk behind it, this is never going to be useful, or it's not going to be actionable by either a SOC team, by a developer to actually go fix, without having some sort of context into what the real risk is behind it. And so I don't feel like this is a, this is not like a light bulb moment, right? Like, we, you know, obviously this was, you know, they came up with that SDT or whatever they called it back in the 50s about the different types of positives and negatives when you're detecting issues or exploits or attacks or whatever it is. It's more iterative. Like over time, we have learned how to deal with this. And it feels like this is kind of, they're coming at it from a SOC perspective. So obviously they've been sitting around in a security operations center. They've been seeing these alerts that are popping up and they realize that they're spending a lot of time on things that have no business impact, right? So it might be positive that there was an attack that came in that was targeting some specific version of Apache, for example, but it didn't actually go against an Apache server. So there's no business impact to that. Now, that doesn't mean that there isn't some value to seeing that alert pop up, but it just means the severity of what you are going to do or the action that you are going to take when you see that is different than those that are completely malicious, that can be effective, that can be used to do something like account takeover, right? I keep trying to frame this in the context of application security specifically, right? Like, I feel like our breakdown in this refined classification would be a little different, right? Not necessarily confirm malicious activity requiring a response, but hey, confirmed vulnerability requiring a fix, right? That's really what we're looking at. And then I also worry a little bit if we do focus only on like the true positives and false positives, that we forget a little bit about the false negatives and the true, like the true negatives, obviously we're not concerned about, right? If there's no exploit, there's no vulnerability, that's fine. But the false negative is where I start to get concerned as well, right? Like, this is the reason why we keep expanding our tool sets. We keep building out additional patterns that we are looking for in code, in applications, because the unknown unknowns are what keep us up at night when someone finds a new exploit for S3 or something else, right? Like, that is a very real concern. So we've got to be able to respond to that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah. I think there are some other bits where to go from that, from what you just said. So no, like I obviously I agree, like false negatives, for sure. That's yeah, 100% an issue. And I was thinking about it, like, what are the things that people are automating with AI, right? SOC is one of them. And this is why this article really, believe it or not, the thing that really stuck out to me was at the very, very top where they go, where they said, ask anyone who's worked in a SOC long enough and they'll tell you debates over true positive versus false positive happen a lot. Usually the conversation goes in circles. One person insists an alert was a false positive. Another argues it was technically a true positive. Now, why do I say that? Like, that struck me because now we have a situation where humans themselves struggle to make this determination, but then you're offloading your SOC activities to an AI system, correct? So now you're asking an AI system, which is probably doing what a lot of us do, which is having some level of judgment happening amongst various LLMs, where they become kind of like people arguing over whether or not this is a true positive, a false positive, or whatever. And that's why I thought it kind of just, it's always interesting to me when we try to automate our work, that there are a lot of human nuances and subtleties that somehow we assume tools will just be able to capture and decide like we would. And that's not so. So as I'm kind of circling back to the SOC AI analyst thing here, I'm like, well, yeah, if humans struggle, these systems will struggle. And I liked that they kind of went the direction of not just here are some ways to classify what is a false positive, true positive, whatever, but also if you go to the very bottom, they talk about different metrics that you can capture on top of. So if I, let me scroll down. It was, okay, the metrics SOCs don't know they need. So SOC leaders often say they want to reduce false positive. That sounds good, but it's incomplete. The metrics they actually need are, how often does this role lead to a meaningful investigation? and how much analyst time does it consume when it does? And then they further expand and they say why this matters for detection engineering. Using intent and disposition alongside true false positives lets you track precision, how often the rule fires correctly, impact rate, how often correct alerts have security value, and investigation cost, average analyst time per impactful alert. So nothing groundbreaking, but I do think it's interesting in this world where we're beginning to have to codify human activities in order to have automated systems behave similar to us, that someone took the time to kind of delineate these various factors that could lead to a good signal and then gave some ideas around metrics to show value. And I thought that was neat. And that's really why I, you know, wanted this article to come to light and be discussed. Sorry, yeah. I saw some, so now I'm catching up. Argument always revolves around burden. If you remove the burden on a human, I mean, let me just put this up on the screen. So Robert says, in the SOC context, the argument always revolves around burden. If you remove the burden on a human, people align on a true positive fault. So is that the burden, Seth, how are you, is this the burden to deal with it, or?
Yeah, who has to actually respond is my takeaway there, right? Yeah.
Okay.
Which I can understand, right? Like, you know, people, you know, in general want to reduce the number of the amount of time that they spend on something that ends up being a false positive, right? You know, selfishly, like they want that time to do other things, which is rightfully so. You know, if you can show that it's a false positive quickly, it means that you can move on to something that maybe is a true positive and respond to that in a SOC context. And I'm not just talking about, you know, somebody just being lazy or whatever it is that doesn't want to dive into that. I'm saying, like, that is the goal is to quickly classify something as a false positive, a true false positive, so that you can move on to what really matters, right? And I don't know, like, I want to frame this in the terms of application security and what you and I do on a daily basis. So, like, you are building a detection engineering product, right? It's not about alerts, it's not about attacks, but it's about vulnerabilities in code, right? So how do you feel about this metric in front of us here on how often the rule fires correctly?
Yeah, I mean, that's a major, well, for me, it's twofold. It's not just how correct, but does it do it on multiple iterations? That's something that's really important when you work with these systems, is that they can repeat it. Like, we have to be able to run through 4, 5, 10 times and have the same result every time. And in a probabilistic system, that's your biggest battle. That's why people have asked me, like, in a couple of situations, they're like, oh, are you worried about Claude Code security review tool? And I'm like, no, not at all. Like, it's good enough for like an open source project. It's good enough for a very small team with a low budget, to no budget. Sure, I guess, but no, it requires serious, like, you and I teach people how to do this. It requires tons of orchestration. Once people get in the course, they're like, oh, that's why, like, this is so hard. It's like, yeah, there's a million things you have to do right. And, there's constant evaluation. So I should just get back to your original question, which is like, yeah, it's not just is that signal, and we've got an evaluation framework, and we've written blogs about how we do that with sample size data, and then doing an LLM as a judge. I call it battle of the bots to get to truth, and the metrics that we use to stay above a certain percentage of accuracy and all that stuff. But again, it's multiple runs. I think why this interests me is not just my job, but actually just I've been thinking so much about how to codify human activities in general and codify value. And it turns out us humans, and I know Andrew, shout out to Andrew Wilson, right? He's Andrew's been on the show, and I know he's in the middle, and you and I talk to him pretty frequently. He was building a thesis around some of these exact things, where he was mapping out and interviewing pen testers and code reviewers and folks like that, to get an understanding of, you know, how do they think when they, literally codifying their approach and their mindset and their thought process. And that's really why this matters to me, right? Because we're getting into a new world where a lot of people are trying to automate human tasks with something that's closer to a not a human, but closer to a human than the low hanging fruit stuff that we used to do. And this is an important topic. You know, I think it's going to become incredibly important as time goes on.
Yeah. I mean, it is, right? And I do feel like we could expound on this, right? And maybe that's something that we can take offline as far as like how we would approach this same discussion from a code or from a dynamic analysis perspective, right? Because, you know, precision, how often the rule fires correctly is, you know, very important, like how well written the rule is, how well, like what kind of impact it has on you, on the security analyst that's actually reviewing what's happening, whether or not they're doing deep dives or going down rabbit holes based on what the tools are telling them. Like we've all spent a ton of time jumping into those sorts of, of those sorts of results, right? And so I do feel like this can be, we should expand on this, right? Or we should expand on the research here, just because I think it would be interesting from your perspective, developing a tool, from my perspective in like the sorts of vulnerability reduction techniques that we use, the way that we evaluate risk from a scope perspective. And then we should probably even bring someone in that's on a security team and is doing this on a daily basis for an organization, because we've got multiple different perspectives on how that impact drives things, how context matters, what sort of formulas you're using or algorithms you're using to determine this false positive rate and this, you know, true positive rate, and then what you actually do with it. There's a lot to it. That's, I guess that's where I'm going with it. I know I'm kind of, you know, rambling right now, but it feels like there's a lot to it that we could dive into to help people codify their own analysis. I think that's what becomes difficult, is how do you codify that? Because every organization is different. And so every program and process is going to be different per organization. And there's no one standard that's going to be effective for every single organization that's out there.
No, definitely not. And actually, I'd even argue within a team, within a department, within an organization, you probably would struggle. And obviously Robert's comments kind of hint to that. You struggle with what's real and what's not. I mean, that's the tough. Yeah. It's just a tough space at times when you're trying to automate things and trying to provide value. In any case, I thought it was just like a neat article. It's something a little outside the norm. And I found value in it and was very appreciative that someone took the time to write this up. So who was the author actually? Magonia Research.
Yeah. Magonia.io. Signal Blur is his name, whatever, or his handle, I should say. Good article. Yeah. Good discussion. All right. So where do you want to go from here? Which do you want to talk about NPM debug and that takeover of accounts? Or do you want to talk about?
Yeah, I'll talk about it. I mean, so let me put this Aikido article in. It was their researchers who, I guess, discovered this. I'm going to give you my personal. So I saw this yesterday. I'll just say this. I saw this yesterday. The window for when it was exploitable seems to be like a few hours. Obviously, I had to go and run an incident. Or I wouldn't say run an incident, but I had to go do some digging to make sure we weren't exploited and like track that and, you know, write up tickets and stuff. So it sucked. I'm not going to lie. That sucked yesterday. That was not super fun. I don't know. Do you want to summarize what happened? Do you need me to, do you want me to, or do you want to summarize? What happened in this?
Let me share here. Right. Like I always find, so we know if you can get access to someone's account, maintainer's account for NPM or any package repository that, especially for popular packages, that bad things can happen, right? So the takeover here is probably the most interesting thing, because that exposes that initial compromise that happens, and whether or not it is like application security related, whether or not it's people related, right? And what actually happens there, right? To Robert's point, you know, good fish, right? Like, and so that's kind of what I jumped to. Like, it's one thing to see what's actually happening, that they were like mining, or they basically were trying to do cryptocurrency draining and transfer money to a specific, like Bitcoin to a specific wallet, through the use of these various libraries that are being pulled into millions and millions of projects, right? I should have articles for this, but I don't have it up. But I saw that someone was doing analysis on the target wallets where they were trying to get money transferred to those. And, you know, all of all the millions of packages that they could have compromised and the things they could have done, turns out they made like at most $500 yesterday, right? On top of that, right? So it wasn't like this massive, massive windfall for taking over this person's account.
Yeah, Anthony posted an article on Twitter where they're like, it's $66 or something. I'm sure it's more than that now. Yeah, it's like $66.
took over millions of accounts. Yeah, it cracked me up, right? Like, this is not knowing what you have access to and following some pattern that you probably should have looked at a little bit closer before you compromise them. Anyway, so the compromise here was a fish, right? So apparently the maintainer clicked on a link. And yeah, what actually happened there? The email basically saying update your 2FA. And I mean, this is pretty standard, right? Like, oh, look, there's some random npmjs.help, right? Yeah. It's people. It's exploiting people. It's exploiting someone that probably just wasn't paying attention at the time. The email looked like it was valid, and reset their 2FA. Honestly, that's probably what, you know, behind the scenes, that's what happened. And then once that account was compromised, they were able to update the packages and do a, you know, put some malicious content in there. And it was noticed fairly quickly. Like, we got a lot of services like Akaido that are now monitoring NPM and other package repositories for this sort of activity. Paul does this quite a bit too, right? At 6 Mile on Slack. And so it's becoming increasingly common.
Yeah, it is.
I don't know.
It sucks. It just sucks, man. Yeah, it's not fun.
Like, it's not.
I will say this. This is good job to NPM. So I just want to say that, because I think it was only like a 3-hour window where this was you know, I mean, I say only 3 hours. I know within 3 hours, that's like millions of downloads. I get that. But in any case, one thing that was really neat is, as part of our build system, we always run bundle audit before we do bundle install, right?
Yeah.
I said bundle. Jeez. Wrong ecosystem there, Seth. NPM audit. Before NPM. My God.
You and your Ruby, right? You're just falling back to the your origin story there. Yeah.
It's definitely not being old and trying to keep track of too much. It's definitely not that, Seth. It's my love of Ruby. We run NPM audit before we run NPM install. And what was really neat is we got some errors saying like, hey, yeah, deep in the rails. You're right, Robert. You know, we got some alerts saying like, we can't actually build your system because there are some malicious libraries that have been uploaded to the registry or something like that. I don't remember the exact error. And so I was like, oh my God, that was really nice, right? As I'm doing this retrospective, just doing this incident. And again, it's maybe not even an incident response, but doing an investigation just to be safe. I stumbled across those, and the team had written up some tickets on it. And it was just really awesome. It was like, good job to NPM, because like I said, yes, this developer was exploited. Yes, they required 2FA on their account. Yes, that was bypassed via social engineering. But also, yes, it was a short window and NPM had some protections put in place before before folks like myself could go and install them. So, yeah, I don't know what to say. Like, this stuff happens. It sucks. I'm really, it's unfortunate, but it is also, it's like, you know, if you're going to rely on free software, which we all do, this is the risk. You know, The risk is you could take forever. Well, I guess less so maybe with AI and vibe coding or whatever, but still, I mean, you realistically, you're still going to need libraries from open source repositories in most cases, if you want to move at any kind of decent space. So then you just have to accept that risk and have some protections in place and be ready for when these, libraries do get, malicious libraries do get published.
Yep.
I haven't seen this talked about enough. What does Robert mean by that? Sorry, Seth.
Oh.
Being the incident or what?
In the rails or off the rails. Yeah, I'm not sure on that. I was just going to call out, right, like, at least the maintainer just kind of owned up to it as well, right? Like, you know, if you see his response on, you know, Hacker News, you know, he was commenting about what was going on. He's like, yeah. And he basically said, looked legitimate at first glance, right? This is it. Like, the fishers nowadays are waiting for that just like moment of indecision, because everybody knows, yeah, we typically don't click on links in emails. But guess what? We still click on links and emails, especially when it's something that looks trusted, that it's something that we're dealing with, or he's had a long morning and was just trying to knock something off the list and click the link instead of going to the site, because it's easier, right? Like, we default to least resistance, the path of least resistance. And so I can't blame it. Like, we've all done this, right? Like, maybe we didn't get punished for it, but we've all done this at some level.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, maybe not at that level, but yeah. No, but I know what you mean. Yeah, we've all been kind of rushing through things and made, you know.
That's what I mean, right? Like, it's human nature to take that path of least resistance. And yes, it would have only taken another 2 seconds to actually go to the site itself and type that in, but the link was right there, you know? Yeah.
They
unexpected though. Like, did it come in unexpectedly? Right. Like, I don't know. Right. Like, we could, you know, we can cast aspersions all we want, but at least he owned up to it, I guess, is my.
Everybody makes mistakes. That's why I didn't even talk about the maintainer much. Cause like, that to me is irrelevant. Humans just make mistakes. And phishing is one of those things where it's like, you know, people have a lot of opinions about phishing, you know, a lot of, I don't tend to so when I worked at GitHub, Patrick Toomey on the team, we were going through and looking at a phishing exercise. And he said something, I don't want to like misquote him, but he said something I really agree with, which is basically like, URLs are URLs, they get passed everywhere. People are going to click on them. If that's what we think the value is getting people to stop clicking on those URLs, like it's the wrong focus, because somebody is going to make that mistake. One person. All it takes is one person. What you should be focused on are all of the other controls to mitigate the impact of when somebody clicks on that URL. And I really, he said it in a better way. And I really don't remember the exact phrasing, but I agree with that. I don't think the onus is on the individual not to click on the URL. I think it's on us to have some protections for when that does happen, because it will happen inevitably.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the AI browser full of fish. Oh yeah, that's going to happen.
It is coming, right? Like, and the creation of phishing emails using AI nowadays, they do sound more like a normal person, right? Like the fishers are getting better at it, right? Through the use of AI. Yeah. So you're just going to see it happen more and more. And that's become a lot of the discussion. Like I just, recently did a threat model with a client. And this was one of the discussions that we were having is, what does response look like? What are the Crocs and socks of your program look like? Monitoring, alerting, logging. Have you actually tested that? Like, what happens when something goes wrong? And what does your response look like? Because if you're not flexing those muscles when it does actually happen, it is probably going to be harder than you expected. Or you might not have the right information to make those calls. And if you don't, then the exposure is going to exist for longer than you would like. So business risk just goes up. Like, assumed breach, right? I like that state, or that that term from the red team community, is just like, we test based on assumed breach. The use of a phishing, like a phishing campaign nowadays, somebody's going to click on that link. They're always successful. Somebody's going to put in their credentials. So let's assume that it's going to happen. How do we respond to it instead of blaming people and trying to get them to stop clicking on links?
Yeah, I think it's detection. It's hardened. It's patching. It's all of the things, right? But I don't think it's like blaming humans or like, you know, unless it's like, I'm sure there's certain situations where it's like, all right, you should have known better. But for most people, yeah, it's innocent mistakes. I think what it's just really kind of highlighting, and I don't remember where I had seen this article, because, you know, you and I read a lot of articles trying to prep for this podcast. Most of them do not make the cut. There was one I saw where it actually talked about like the frustration behind SBOMs being created and generated and people using them for more like a check in the box, like we do that, and then like here you can, but something I think they called out that I agree with is not having those SBOMs operationalized to the extent that they could be used, right, to prevent to assist with these types of situations. I guess what I'm trying to say is, people are generating SBOMs to meet requirements. They're passing those SBOMs around, but in terms of making them operationally effective and you know, helping them force multiply in situations like this, really not a lot there.
So you're saying that people are generating SBOMs for their program or for their applications, but they're not necessarily using them to do like this sort of threat analysis?
Like IR response. That's what the article said. I don't remember this is why it sucks. I shouldn't even record it because I don't have the article link in front of me, but it was a whole thing on like how SBOMs aren't used to their full what they were originally designed to do and be used for. They're not being used to the full extent of what they offer capability wise. And so I don't know if that's true. If do you disagree? Do you see that being not the case?
Well, I don't know, because like realistically, I'm not in the incident response space that much, right? Most of the time, like if I see SBOMs, then I am utilizing that for like dependency check, like just checking to see what the health of a program is. And actually, that is one like indicator of maturity, if I can coin a term there, for an organization, is how out of date their third-party dependencies are and what's actually going into the SBOM. So the second that you start to see dependencies that are 4 or 5 years out of date, that there are CVEs in there, even if they're not exploitable, right? Like even if it's, you know, it's a non-exploitable package or function or whatever it is, like traceability and all the other analysis that goes into it, right? Like, but from a strict indication of maturity or indicator of maturity, analyzing those SBOMs is a really interesting practice, because it does tell me very quickly whether or not there are going to be problems with, hey, there's new techniques, there's new programming patterns that we should be using, there's new libraries that should be available for, you know, whatever, like, you know, exploit reduction, vulnerability reduction, firewall rules, like all that sort of stuff. And if they're not doing the basics, then most likely a lot of the other things are going to fire as well.
Yeah, and I don't, I, The truth is, I don't spend a lot of time with organized, like, well, that, okay. I don't, I'm not, you do a lot of interfacing and people stuff with many, many different organizations, right? So like I guess my question is like, do you see a lot of SBOM usage or SBOM generation? And then second to that is, what do you see people, if you do, like how are they using them, internally?
Most of the time, like most of what I see, especially the organizations I deal with, is if they do SBOM generation, and I would say it's a minority of companies that I deal with that do any sort of SBOM generation, period. It's just not something that's been picked up by smaller organizations, realistically, unless there is a requirement from one of their, either from a compliance framework or from one of their customers, that they generate an SBOM. Those are realistically the only two situations where I see most SaaS companies, most companies that I deal with and I assess, generating an SBOM. And then when they do, they generate it periodically or only for the release that's targeted to that company, or only because it's in their SOC 2 Type 2 list of things that they need to generate. And no one really looks at it. Right. This is the traditional compliance catch that you get is, oh, well, I have to generate an SBOM, but that doesn't mean I have to actually do anything with the results that are in there. Oh, I have to do a network vulnerability scan, but as long as I give that to the auditor and they don't look too closely, I don't actually have to act on anything that's in there, right? That sort of an activity. So I know that's very cynical, but it is, I, it's true to life on what I'm seeing.
Oh, I don't think it's cynical. And that's what the article said. They're like, for those that do use it, it's primarily a requirement for some reason or another. And then in terms of like the idea wasn't so that you generate them and then like, boom, you're now compliant with some arbitrary requirement. The goal was to make meaningful asset mapping essentially and tracking of what you're using so that when there is a situation like this, you have an easy way to, I think there's more to it than that. I know that there's more to it than that, but this is one of the reasons, this is one of the cases spelled out was for like incident response command. By the way, I did want to give a shout out because Robert brought up that, and I agree with this. I don't think there's like a lot of, because I've done plenty, and so I'm sure so have you, like plenty of tabletops and incident response playbook runs and stuff like that. And they're useful up to a certain point when you're the one building them and running those exercises. I wouldn't say they provide no value, but it would be nice if there was someone you could go to where they did that for you and helped you out. And apparently he says that BlackRock 3 is a place you can go. And I put the link in there, blackrock3.com, to get that kind of, he says it's useful. So I trust Robert. If he says it's useful, I'll go with it. But yeah, because I actually recently ran an incident. It wasn't for security. It was a different type of incident response. As part of SOC 2, you're required to run those periodically. So I ran one recently and I was thinking, man, I wish somebody else could do this for me. This is a pain to put together and run. So yeah, next time I'll just pay money.
Okay. So, and like, I have a question for you. So, to get back to the SBOM discussion, right? It feels like supply chain security, SBOMs was a really big thing up until, oh, about 2 years ago, right? And then all the air got sucked out of the room by AI and LLMs and AI security, and everybody like changed focus. Is that the reason why SBOMs have not been adopted?
Yeah, maybe.
I'm just, it's pure conjecture at this point, but it does feel like we changed focus, right? And granted, the security industry is known for this, right? There's still people that talk about supply chain security. There's still people that are doing, traceability analysis and exploitability and all the different things within the supply chain space. But SBOMs was really huge a couple of years ago on, the Black Hat conference floor. Everybody was talking about how you had to generate SBOMs and review them, and then AI happened, basically. That at least that's what it feels like to me, right? Like there was
So you're
Web3, there was
saying
SBOM.
it took away the focus. Is that what you're saying? It took away the focus.
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think there's people still working on the problem, but it does feel like an interesting graph problem that you could probably solve for incident responders, for analysis, right? If you were able to generate SBOMs for all the products that you were dependent upon and insert those into some sort of a graph database and quickly look up, hey, who is actually dependent on this version of debug, right? But it's not something that is, I guess it's not talked a lot about anymore, right?
I know there's like, I think anyway, it's cost, is it Cyclone DX? Is that what I'm thinking of? That help with that?
That sounds right.
That's the OWASP Cyclone DX standard. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know. I need to do more homework before I open my stupid mouth and say things that I'm not educated enough on to say things about. But I will say, like, I think that's what Cyclone DX, the intention was, is to help make this an official standard that's operationalized. But yeah, I won't go any further because I'll just say something stupid like usual. Yeah. But
no, to Robert's point, right? Like, product didn't want SBOM. It was not necessarily something that's really all that interesting, because it's like, if you can get that, you can do this analysis. But now, like, AI popped up, so security switched focus to that, to secure AI. And
you know, I did use AI. Yes, I used our own MCP server yesterday to see if in the last 24 hours we introduced any updates with these introduced the libraries or updated the libraries. I just did a quick search. So it did make it really easy for me. Now that you mentioned that, it did make it really easy using our MCP server for me to, and I think we're going to post something for I guess I shouldn't talk about that, but I think we're going to show what that means. But yeah, you can use, like, to your point, you can use these systems that capture like your changes over a period of time to search for, do this without having an SBOM is my
SBOM, point. Yeah. Well, that's always been it, right? Like, whether or not you need an SBOM, you can detect these issues without it, right? So yes, you have something in place that's actually already looking at your pulls and like code, the versions that are being used. You can query that quickly. SBOM is supposed to make it easier and is supposed to expose that risk to third parties, so you have something to give someone else that tells them what you're using and what your dependencies are, so they can evaluate that risk. We're just kind of going down paths now. We don't necessarily need to belabor that point. I think we've done enough of that. So.
Oh, we're at 57 minutes in. Oh my gosh, Seth.
I know.
Oh, and I'm late for a meeting too. Thankfully, I got other people on it that are more important than me to that discussion. So don't worry about that. I'm good. But I didn't realize the time and that we'd already been going for almost an hour. Holy cow. That really flew by. My God. Wow. Well, so like, what else do you have going, just to wrap things up? Like, what else do you have going on, you know, kind of the remainder of this quarter? I guess you're about to hit
Q4. This quarter. Yeah. If you need Q4 help, please reach out now, not in October, November, because that is we're already booking multiple weeks crossed. I mean, Q4 is looking really busy for us, which is not out of the norm, but we do still have availability, I guess. Not a ton, but enough that we could help people out. And
yeah, I was lucky to get you in on time for my time limits. Yeah. You know, I have your So I was grateful to get you all in there. And thank you. You found good stuff. So thank you. That's helpful.
You want us to talk about it, right? Like, some of those were interesting, right? Anyway, right? Like, we don't have to dive into like company.
Fun to have your. Go and pen test your stuff. It's cool. Yeah. But anyways, I know you're about to get pretty swamped. I did want to reiterate that we've got the training next month, I guess, October 9th and 10th, Harnessing LLMs. We'll show you some actually, you're going to get the benefit of 2 years, 3 years, over 2 years of experience day in and day out operationalizing LLM systems. So backed systems. So it'll be good. So what's your, sorry, last question. So you said this Friday you're going to B-Sides Cache, and then what, and then, sorry, what was after that?
So there is B-Sides Red Rock. I've got some, client travel. I'm going to be down in like the Sacramento area, end of this month. If anybody's around that area and wants to get together, I think that's the second to last week in September. So it's a couple weeks out. And then B-Sides Cache, B-Sides Red Rock is November. I don't know if I'm going to be back for OWASP Global, AppSec, DC, whatever the name of those conferences are now. Just haven't decided, right? Like, talks and stuff didn't get picked up. So it's more of a, well, we'll see, right?
I'm in the same boat. I'm like, I don't know. Like, maybe I'll go there and do some dinners or something, which is, I don't know.
Yeah, we'll see. So, I mean, it would be good to see the people that are going to be there. There's quite a few friends, obviously, that are going to be around and in that area, and clients and other, other interested parties. So I may be back for that. But otherwise, like, the big things are the B-Sides events here, and then the Black Hat Europe, the training that will be there in London. I'm excited for that one. Yeah. Otherwise, I think that's about it for today, unless you have anything else you want to talk through.
No, I talk enough. I'm good.
No, I talk enough. That sounds about it. All right. Well, thanks everybody for joining today. Thanks for the commentary interactions. Robert, always good to have your feedback on things as well. And
thank you, Robert.
We'll see everybody next
week. Heck, is Leisure Suit Larry. Larry, you got to come back, man. I don't know where we saw that at Vegas and got a bunch in Vegas, but yeah, I like his commentary too.
Yeah, exactly. All commentary is good commentary. Well, I don't know about that, but yes, there we go. Cool. All right.
Well, thank you, everybody.
Thanks, everybody. See y'all next week. Ciao.